very nice city and a nice seminar on cities, and I understood that it's also part of a series on inflexible or flexible cities. So I think this topic really fits well into that idea. So yes, indeed, I want to talk about both obduracy and vulnerability. So in this presentation, I would like to combine some of my earlier work in Unbuilding Cities, my book, and my newer work, more recent work, on disasters and urban vulnerability. Maybe I should first clarify that my point of view, my perspective on cities is not that from the perspective of an urban scholar. So I take a kind of a different perspective because I'm trained in the field of science, technology and society studies, also abbreviated as STS. And in that field, of course, we focus on science and scientific and technological development, but always in relation to society and culture. So we try to study the interrelations between technology and society. And trying to apply that perspective to the city, I came to conceptualize the city as a kind of huge socio-technical artifact, consisting of, like, of course, human citizens, like groups of people, but also if you look around you, like houses, buildings, bridges, tunnels, I mean, all kind of infrastructure, and that together, those material and social parts make up the city. And in our perspective, we usually take a social constructivist perspective to technological developments. We focus a lot on the role of actors or relevant social groups. I will also give an example later on. Their role in shaping like cities or shaping technological artifacts. And we take a kind of cultural approach, looking at the meanings they attach to these material infrastructures, the meanings they attach to technological artifacts, and in this case, to urban space. And the idea is that by giving these meanings, they construct a specific urban reality. So there's no urban reality like of itself, there's no inherent characteristic of the urban, no, it's constructed by the actors involved in making urban space. And third, we also focus a lot on the role of historical context in shaping cities and also on the role of contingency, just arguing that developments are not like linear or following a specific law-like trajectory. No, it can also be, it could also have been different, it could have been otherwise. And that's the role of contingency in the development of urban space. So in this presentation today, I focus on two issues on the STS research agenda that are closely related to urban developments or urban problems. One of them is the issue of socio-technical change, and this relates to this issue of flexibility or inflexibility of cities. To what extent can we change cities anymore when they are in place? And the second issue on the STS research agenda is the vulnerability of technological cultures. I will come back to them to both of these points. Because those points on the STS research agenda relate to two, I think, pressing important problems in cities. The first is the obduracy of existing urban structures. Once urban structures are in place, that's the point of my book, Unbuilding Cities, they become resistant to change. It's hard to change urban structures once they are there, once they have become embedded. So it's really a book, a project about slow change, the very much effort it takes to change urban structures. And then the second problem is that also in urban settings, disasters happen, of course. And then the kind of disasters that I focus on are very sudden disasters, like explosions. We'll give an example later on, where like a whole part of the city is all of a sudden demolished, and then a whole rebuilding has to take place. And then we talk about like very sudden, very radical change. So it's really the opposite of the slow change that I talk about or that I worked on in relation to problem of obduracy. So in this presentation, I will present two case studies to you, one about urban obduracy and one about an urban disaster, and then try to discuss what we can learn from both like examples. First, the example of urban obduracy. So this is, as I said, about the tensions between the attempts to change cities, but then also the obduracy of the existing infrastructures. And then the key question of my work was, why is it so difficult to change cities once urban structures are in place? And I will discuss one example with you, and that is the example of a city center, a shopping mall combined with a railway station in the Dutch city of Utrecht. I don't know if you've ever been there. It's really in the central part of the Netherlands. And I analyzed this case study, the time span was between 1988-1999 somewhere. And the problem was that in the 1960s, a really like huge shopping mall was built in that station area. And already from the beginning, people were very like annoyed about this. Also the citizens, but also the city board. It's really ugly, they thought it's really just one concrete block and we don't like it. So in the late 1980s, they thought about rebuilding this area. This is just one, a part of the shopping mall that you can see here. And one of the key characteristics of this shopping mall is that the part of it, or at least a large part, is built on 6 meters above street level. So you have these pedestrian corridors. Also, some, not this one, but the others are lined with shops. This is how the area looks like. So here, this is the shopping mall. This is connected to the railway station, and then there's also a connection with the industries fair. It's called the Jaarbeurs. So it's a real huge area within this like very nice and old medieval city center of Utrecht. So in this project, the Utrecht City project, they try to reconstruct this whole station area and also the shopping mall. And in my work, I distinguish three relevant social groups in these developments. Those groups that play an important role, try to influence the decision-making process. The owner of the mall, that's a large pension fund, ABP, the city board of Utrecht, and then also the citizens of Utrecht. And in my work, I link this, I try to understand their role, the role of these three groups, and how they try to play a role in this rebuilding process. With the concept of technological frame. And this is a notion introduced by Lieber Beiger, and he is an SDS person, and he developed the social construction of technology model. And I will just briefly explain a bit about this concept. It's comparable to Kuhn's paradigm. I think you have heard about this term. And the idea is that a technological frame is built up when the interactions around a certain technological artifact begin, and that these technological frames at the same time also structure the interactions between the members of a relevant social group. And I will give an example later to show you how this concept works in this concrete example. In the case of Hoge Catharijne, or this Utrecht City project, I distinguish two competing technological frames. One called the ground floor frame, and that was then kind of advocated by the city board, and the other one, the raised level frame, advocated by the ABP, the owner of the shopping mall. And this is an overview of how these two frames look like in my analysis. Frames consist of goals, how they define the problems involved, how they think about strategies to solve the problems, and also in consisted of design principles. And just to clarify this, the ground floor frame of the city board was really focused on improving the quality of the ground floor in this whole station area and of Hoge Catharijne, the shopping mall, because they thought this is a very poor area. I mean, there's a lot of problems there. There are drug addicts. It's really a lot of crime going on there below the raised level at 6 meters. So they wanted to improve the public safety of that area by creating more like pedestrian routes on the ground floor, and even by demolishing this 6 meter plus raised level. And their design principle was to mix like all kind of functions, and also pedestrians with cars with bicycles. So you have a lot of them in the Netherlands, also here, I see. level frame that was advocated by the AUP, the owner of the shopping mall, consisted of trying to improve the shopping mall at a raised level. For them, the problem was, well, this shopping mall is not so popular among the citizens of Utrecht, so we should try to improve the image of the raised level, and we should broaden the passages, we should make them more attractive, we should add more shops, and we should really try to preserve the segregation of vertical, that you have the raised level and then the ground level is not that important in their technological frame. Now, to analyze the role of obduracy in relation to these technological frames, we need another concept, and that's the notion of inclusion. And that has to do with the degree in which the technological frame of these actors determines their actions. And then you can speak of high and low inclusion. So high inclusion is when the actions and interactions of the actors are to a very high degree determined by the technological frame, and low inclusion is when this is like not really or not much determined by the technological frame. And then Dijker makes a distinction between high inclusion, and he links that to closed-in obduracy, and low inclusion, and that's linked to closed-out obduracy. And closed-in obduracy, I will just elaborate this example. Closed-in obduracy means that the actors really cannot think outside of their technological frame. They can only think about solutions within this technological frame. And this applied to both the owner of the shopping mall, AEP, and the city board. So they saw many possibilities for variation within their technological frame, but only few outside. And my claim is in my book that this kind of status quo, those two very rigid technological frames of those two key actors, that they could not think and that they could not really understand each other's position, or at least could not find a solution that would bridge these two positions, that this resulted in the obduracy of this urban artifact. And actually this status quo of these two technological frames existed for more than 10 years. So for 10 years there was no really possibility for change. And then also to show some examples of urban plans that they made also in relation to their way of thinking, to their technological frame. This is a plan developed by the city board, and you can really see that they try to make like connections, even try to break through existing buildings to create ground floor connections between this is the railway station and then this is the old city center. So this is an example of really a ground floor plan. And this is another example, a later master plan, but then also really focused on, Utrecht is famous for its canals, like Amsterdam. And this is at the moment this is a huge, like a highway through the city, but the idea was to open this again and to bring water back into this area, also with the idea to improve the ground floor connections in this part of the city and to reintroduce like a nice water course. So this is again an example of the city board trying to promote their ground floor frame. Then the other important group, so now I discussed the importance, the technological frames of the ADP and of the city board, but of course the citizens of Utrecht also play a role in the discussion. But they experience a different kind of obduracy than the two opposing frames of ADP and the city board. So they experience what I would call, in relation to Pijter's work, closed out obduracy. So this means that they did not think at all in terms of the existing technological frames, but had really their own ideas. They were not so like well organized, the citizens of Utrecht, so they were like separate like groups trying to sometimes argue against the plans of the city board, but their plans did not take the existing technological frames into account. And this resulted in quite radical proposals for change. And this, according to Biker, is also typical for actors with a low inclusion. They just have a kind of take it or leave it position. And this is an example of a plan made by a citizen, an architect. He did this just by himself. I mean, he was not a member of an activist group or something, but he made a plan which included the kind of demolition of a large part of the shopping mall, and he created a new, like, large park with nice trees and meadows and everything at the location of the current where now the shopping mall is. So this is kind of a radical proposal: demolition of the shopping mall, or at least a large part of it, and making a nice public space instead. So this plan never made it, but it's, at least it's interesting to see how people, groups with a low inclusion into the existing technological frames or the current technological frames, can come up with very radical proposals for urban change. Then, just discuss this briefly. Biker also developed a configuration model. Depending on how many technological frames dominate the discussions, the debates on technological development, he distinguishes between situations where there are many radical innovations possible and situations where it's likely that, yeah, there will only be like conventional solutions. So in situation one, where there's no dominant technological frame, then the hypothesis is that this may result in many different radical innovations. Then there's situation two, where you have one dominant technological frame, and then innovations dominated by one group will be conventional usually, so not so radical again, or not so radical in this case. And then situation three, and that is the situation that we had in the Hoge Catharijne case. There are two or more dominant technological frames, and then usually there will be a kind of a mixture, an amalgamation of frames that result in conventional solutions. And also in this case, we had two dominant technological frames. And this would then, according to this theory, result in a kind of mixture of the ideas of the two frames. So now what happened in this case is that around 1996, an outsider was like introduced into the process, because as I told you, the situation was just stuck in these two like opposing positions, no change possible, only like controversies and discussions, but no real progress there. So they appointed a new town planning supervisor, Riek Bakker, and what she did is she talked to both like parties in the debate, and she tried to acquire a deeper understanding of their backgrounds and of their technological frames, in my terms. And then she came up with a material, like technical town planning solution that indeed tried to unite the two frames. But I would not qualify this solution as not innovative, because I think she very smartly proposed on one hand to demolish a part of the shopping mall, but at the same time also to bridge the ground floor and the raised level in the design of her plan. So this is a picture from her plan. So here you see the city ground floor level, and then this is the railway station, and you see a gradually inclining square connecting the ground floor and the raised level of also the shopping mall. So in her plan, she really quite literally and materially tried to unite the two opposing technological frames. At the same time, because of her strategic skills and the way she talked to the groups involved, a number of redefinitions took place. that resulted in an increased flexibility or malleability of urban space. So all of a sudden for the city, the raised level of this shopping mall was not like this bad, like concrete disaster of the 1960s, but no, it became redefined as a brilliant town planning concept, because it fitted so well in the modernist tradition of town planning. And Riek Bakker, as town planning supervisor, she managed to create this new image of the raised level as a brilliant town planning concept. And she also did like other moves. She made other moves trying to she tried to emphasize it's good that we have a contrast between the city and the station area. We shouldn't try to make it the same. No, it's good that there is a difference there. That's interesting for the city. It's really better to have a more contrast between the two. And also for the ADP, the owner of the shopping mall, they tried to redefine the shopping mall as a fun shopping center. And in the past it was more, they call it a run shopping center, a place where people did not really stay, but just went quickly from the railway station to the nice old city center of Utrecht. But if they would improve the quality of this shopping center into a fun shopping center, it really also improved the image of this shopping mall. So they also got a more positive idea of this whole area. So my argument is that in the end, Riek Bakker, because of these redefinitions that she tried to generate in her working with these two parties, two groups of actors, that she managed to create a new kind of flexibility of urban space, whereas there was obduracy in the past. And I tried to do this methodologically by following these actors involved in the process and the meanings they give to this urban space, to the urban artifacts, by way of analyzing their technological frames. We can also see that urban obduracy is context dependent and can change over time, so it can change from a very stubborn, unchangeable urban artifact towards something that is regains malleability. But at the same time, I must say that now Bakker's solution has not been implemented. So I mean, that's then the next part of the story, which I will not go into. I didn't really study that part. So it can really be a fluctuation, a change from obduracy to malleability back to obduracy again, depending on the time, context, and the people involved. But at least it's important to also look at redefinitions of meanings, because as soon as we have redefinitions of meanings attached to urban space, something will change either in the direction of flexibility or obduracy. Okay, are there any questions so far about this part, about urban obduracy? Yes?
Just a question. The technical frame that people have, is it in their minds, in their education and their way of living, or is it the role they fulfill? Because I imagine if you place the same people from Corio ABB to the government, will they change their mindset quickly, or is it different?
It's not really on the very individual level, it's more on the group level, although you can then say for individual actors they have a lower high inclusion in that particular technological frame. It's partly cognitive, so it's in their minds, it's in their way of thinking, it's their view of the world. But it's also related to, sometimes to education, but that is then very individual. It can be related to the corporate policies of this ADP, for instance. That's also part of that technological frame. It can be just generally how they define their the goals of what they plan to do with this urban space, how they, what kind of problems they see, what kind of solutions they then propose. So it's also partly material in the sense of proposing town plans or plans for change. So it's a mixture of cognitive and material aspects, I would say, elements.
And when the plans changed, were different people involved of
Well, of course, there have been some changes in the management and the people involved, but not that was not really the...
Because they also had a retail complex in New Orleans.
Yeah.
Same problems, they always speak, they don't want to invest, and it's just
Yeah.
Mostly they earn lots of money and they don't care about it.
Okay. Well, yeah. No, but in this case they care, I mean they care about their property and the profits they make. And that is their main, and then they have an idea of how to make sure these profits are like...
For a long time, it's not necessary to do it.
No,
it's
that's
just,
true.
It's just they just did it now because they saw an opportunity.
Yeah.
So they didn't change their minds, and I think it was not because of a different plan.
No, okay.
Can I suggest
yeah.
that perhaps we just have, like, for now, maybe we have a couple of issues, somebody has a point of clarification that we want to sort of factually clarify.
Yeah, because then
questions.
I will move on with the second part.
So we'll leave the
discussion
to keep your sort of
yeah.
your extensive like interrogation still to the end. But if anybody's got a point of clarification, then that then yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, maybe let's leave the discussion.
Yeah. Okay.
Because
okay.
I have hundreds.
Sorry,
of
I didn't want to change.
Our technological frame. Our technological frame has been vulnerabilized.
Okay, so now I move on to the second part of my presentation, where I will focus on the kind of the opposite of urban obduracy, and that is where really a sudden unexpected change takes place, an urban disaster. And I will link this to the STS research agenda of vulnerability. So after September 11, within the field of the history and sociology of technology, there came the idea was, okay, we should deal with these disasters like September 11 are kind of linked to technology, so we should reflect on that, and we should in our field also pay attention to the role of vulnerability in technological cultures. So these are a few references of people who try to put the issue of vulnerability on the agenda. At the same time, in this literature, it's argued that vulnerability should not be seen as something completely negative. It can also be something positive, or at least it poses this question, could vulnerability in our technological culture also be something positive? And then they link it to the relation between disaster and innovation. So if you want to innovate, if you want to create the possibility for change and new things, you need to be a bit vulnerable, because vulnerability creates this opportunity. It makes it possible to improvise, for instance, and it creates the opportunity for change. So in that sense, vulnerability, we cannot live in a world without any vulnerability, so it's there anyway, we have to deal with it, and let's try to find a positive way of dealing with vulnerability. Now, this is, I think, an interesting claim. And I wanted to study this, how and how far vulnerability can also be seen as something positive. And I want to discuss another case study with you. And this is a picture of May 2000, so a bit more than 10 years ago, in the Dutch city of Enschede. It's in the east of the country, where on a nice Saturday afternoon, suddenly a fireworks factory, or at least a facility for storing fireworks, exploded. So this is the area where this explosion took place. Here, I think, was the fireworks facility. And in this disaster, 22 people died, and like a whole area of the city was kind of devastated. So 1,500 houses were demolished, 200 of them completely disappeared. You can see like areas like here where, well, it almost some people said it almost looks like a war scene, and there's nothing like left of it. And 65 acres of urban land were destroyed because of this sudden explosion. Now, this is a picture of the same area. I think this is the place where what I just pointed out, where this fireworks factory was located in the past. And now it's 10 years later, so this picture is quite recent, and it's a completely rebuilt area. So in 10 years' time, a complete redevelopment of this neighborhood took place. And then the questions I want to ask about this case and about more generally cities and disasters is, how do cities respond to disasters? is there anything positive about vulnerability? Can you talk about anything positive looking at this kind of examples? And also, how can we understand the relation between this type of urban disaster, like the sudden disaster, and urban innovation, urban change? And in the previous example, I talked about technological frames, and here I want to introduce another concept, another idea, and that one is narratives of resilience. And I derived that notion from two urban scholars, Bale and Campanella, and they had a very nice edited volume in 2005, Oxford University Press. I think it's The Resilient City, I think that's the title of that book. And they say, we can try to understand how cities cope with disaster by focusing on narratives of resilience. Now, what are narratives of resilience? And the ways that humans assemble stories to explain or inspire processes of recovery. And then usually these narratives of resilience expose a longing to render tragedy in uplifting terms. So here you again have this positive idea. And they are a rhetorical device intended to enhance or restore the legitimacy of government. Because after a disaster, usually many people blame the government, because also in this case, in Enschede, the city government had been much too lenient in giving permits to this fireworks factory. So narratives of resilience then serve the goal of trying to restore the legitimacy of government. This is a bit of work in progress. My methodology in the previous case was to do interviews and to do archival research. So I did a number of interviews with people involved in the rebuilding process. So I didn't really look into the disaster itself, but only the process afterwards. And then one former project director told me our mission was to rebuild the city and make it better than before. We wanted to use a disaster as a source of power, as an opportunity for the city. So here you see, I think, an example of a narrative of resilience where they try to use the disaster to create a kind of uplifting, to try and make it more positive, give it a positive input to the city. And then another interviewee said the disaster offered enormous opportunities. So this he said like 10 years later. I think we can safely conclude that now. So those two people involved in the rebuilding process argue that in the end, the disaster was something positive. And now, let me go back a little bit to the history of this part of the city, because in the rebuilding process, an important role was played by the history of this part of the city of Enschede in the Netherlands. Because this city has a textile industry past. So this is a drawing of around 1900, where you see this part of the city where there are many chimneys of factories around. So it was textile industry, and I think it was after Manchester, one of the biggest sites for textile industry in Europe even. So it was quite important at that earlier time. The urban space, the city was at that time characterized by a mixture of these factories and then working class houses just like mixed in the same area. And important for this story is that in the 1960s, 1970s, this textile industry really went like bankrupt. So there was really a decline of this industry. In the past, many people worked there. But then because of this decline, many people became unemployed, and also many of these factories became just like empty spaces, and they were used for criminal activities, and they were just kind of abused from the 1970s onwards. Now, it's interesting that in the city's coping with this disaster, people involved in the rebuilding process try to place this event in 2000 in a tradition of disaster and recovery in the city of Enschede. So they said, well, we already had some disasters in the past, For instance, in 1862, we had a city fire. At that time, a huge part of the old wooden houses in the city center were destroyed, but also parts of the textile industry that already was there at that time. And in the 1970s, we had another disaster, I mean, of a different type. It's an economic disaster, the decline of the textile industry. And in 2000, then, the third disaster of this fireworks factory. But they also argue that each of these disasters was followed by innovation. So the city fire of 1862, they said, well then, but then afterwards we got steam. So our really it improved our textile industry because then we could more easily bring in this new technology into this industry. And then in the 1970s, the decline of the textile industry, yeah, but then we got a university to the city. So that was the kind of the positive solution to this disaster. And then in 2000, now we also will have something positive because of our the explosion that happened here. So each disaster, they argue in their narratives of resilience, is followed by something innovative. And they even attached, also in their talking about this, in their stories about this, they connect this to the symbol of the phoenix, the mythical bird. You know this? For instance, this is a picture taken in one of the memorial rooms there. They create a memorial with also names of the people who died in the explosion, and they also have this phoenix there on the wall. So the phoenix, the mythical bird that raises from its own ashes again, that's a symbol for this city. And then to continue about narratives of resilience, another way, so this the trend of disasters and recovery and the phoenix symbol, then another way to create a narrative of resilience is to connect the future, the more positive future, with the past. And then in this case, the past of textile and industrial heritage, so also industrial heritage related to the textile industry. In the 1980s, the city of Enschede, its policy was to just demolish all these industrial buildings because they thought this was just rubbish from the past and this is, we don't want to have this, it's only places for crime and so they wanted to demolish them, but this has really changed since the 1990s. Then the trend became to renovate these old factories and also to transform them into places of art and culture, so to make museums, for instance. I will give some pictures of that later on. But after the disaster, the argument of the city board was the industry is important for our identity. So Rome is the name of this neighborhood, so industry, we need it to make a positive connection with this past to create a better future for this area. So this is a picture of an old factory that has now been transformed into a museum. So this is a museum also about textile history. And this is also a tower of one of the former factories now transformed into an apartment with a really nice view. And this is something they are now still working on. This was a building for storing cotton, and now they also really try to transform it and make it fit, make it an appropriate building for an art museum. So this is trying to connect past and a more positive future in the narratives of resilience and also in the material practices after the disaster. And then I have three other examples of how they do this. The first one is to restore the Rome, that's a water course that ran through this area like in the 19th century. It was used to wash the cotton, to clean it. And then it went like, it disappeared underground. And now, similar as in the case of Hoge Catharijne, where they try to bring in this new like canal to create a better public space. They also did the same here. So they try to bring back the water, the water course into this neighborhood. And then they also had a 19th century railway track that was at that time developed by the textile manufacturers, two of them. And they, well, this railway track does not exist anymore. I mean, already since the 1960s it was just gone. But they knew where the trajectory of this railway track was, and they tried to reuse it, but now for public transport in a different way. But it's important in their like telling about this and writing about this, they reconnect this to this 19th century railway track. And then also the cotton bleaching areas, important in the past as areas to bleach the cotton in the sun, like a small park, you could say, at that time in the 19th century. And now they also wanted to reintroduce these areas as a kind of nice public space in this in the new neighborhood. So they don't use them for cotton bleaching anymore, but they have kind of been redefined into nice public spaces. Okay, then I already mentioned that part of the aim of narratives of resilience is to restore the legitimacy of government. So maybe it's also just briefly to look a little bit at the role of the government and how they try to regain legitimacy of the citizens of Enschede. They organized extensive public participation. So that's also part of what I studied for this case study, the role of the public, their ideas about how the area should be rebuilt. They redistributed property rights. So at the beginning, the city board bought the land, property, and then they gave 50% to private ownership for citizens, and they could also choose which house actually they wanted to build there. So there was a lot of freedom for citizens to decide on how they wanted to live in that area, what kind of house they would like to build. And the former residents, so the people who lived there before the disaster, they were given the right to return to this area. Not all of them accepted this, but at least they were given the right to go back to their old neighborhood. And then I think also the narrative of resilience that I just described played an important role in trying to give a more positive image to this neighborhood and also to try to connect the past and future by giving a positive image of, okay, we can recover from this and we can not only recover, but we will be better than before this disaster. Okay, to conclude about the role of urban disasters and then also how cities cope with disasters, I think that in this process of rebuilding this area in Enschede, narratives of resilience played an important role. Then I just mentioned a number of like storylines within these narratives, a better future through urban innovation. They stressed the trend of disaster and innovation by going back to 1862, connecting past and future, stressing that disaster offers opportunities for change and progress, and also by restoring the legitimacy of the city government. Then to come back to the question, okay, is vulnerability then, can we see it as something positive? And I think it's always important to ask, okay, for whom is this positive? And I think that what I've shown, what I've argued, is that vulnerability as something positive is a construction as well. I mean, it's constructed in this way by the people, the actors involved. They try to construct a positive image of the disaster. And in that sense, vulnerability, according to them, is seen as something positive. In newspapers recently, critics of architecture have argued that indeed Enschede has now a really nice, trendy, new middle-class neighborhood. The neighborhood also won a prize, a national prize, for the way this whole process was set up. So in that sense, many people now agree that the city has improved because of this new neighborhood, and that can also be seen as something, as a positive result then of this very devastating event. Okay, this so far about these urban disasters. Now I would like to try and connect, and maybe we can also in our discussion try and make more connections now, because this is actually the first time that I try to think a bit about the relations between the two different cases of urban obduracy, the resistance to change, and urban disasters, where you have very sudden radical change in urban space. And to try and link to obduracy and disasters, and the different changes in urban space they provoke. And then disasters offer opportunities for urban innovation in the sense that they can help to overcome urban obduracy. Yet, even if you look at the process of rebuilding in Enschede, you can see that obduracy still plays a role, even after the disaster, because in one of the other cases that I discussed in my book, Unbuilding Cities, you see that when people try to make connections with the past and try to stick to traditions very much, which we have seen in the case of Enschede, that it also results in obduracy. I mean, you can try and try to link with textile history, for instance, but then it also means that you create innovations that are in a way incremental, in the sense that they already existed in the past. Then you try to do the same things. You try to reintroduce bleaching areas, but you do it in a different way. And I think that I've also shown that in coping with both urban obduracy and vulnerability, cultural meanings play a crucial role. So in one story, it was about meanings embedded in technological frames, and there are those cognitive material frames. And in the second case of Enschede, it was embedded in narratives of resilience, so those stories told about the disaster and the rebuilding process. So in that sense, both obduracy and vulnerability in cities can be analyzed with the same kind of more cultural approach. Okay, I think I'd like to leave it at this. Thank you. And now there's time for questions, I guess.
Yeah, thank you very much. That was really thought-provoking, and there was lots there. So I have about 1,500 questions.
Yeah.
But I'll try and mumble sort of just one through my kind of jet-lagged haze. So I'm really interested in our sort of, I'll just employ my prerogative and then I'll open the floor immediately. But I'm really interested because you're sort of speaking from an SDS perspective.
Yeah.
And obviously now it's difficult to think about SDS without thinking about ACT Network thing, which is
yeah.
kind of
mm-hmm.
the thing that perhaps you could is overlapping with it, but kind of grew out of it. And in the sort of vulgar Latourian sort of explication of ACT Network theory, there is very much meanings, narratives, these kinds of things are elided, and
mm-hmm.
there's a focus on returning to this kind of flat empirical perspective
mm-hmm.
on following actors which normally are not given an opportunity to speak or have not been given an opportunity to speak by sort of linguistic, cultural, sort of meaning-focused accounts that have dominated social science and humanities in the last 50 years, sort of in the Turian voice.
Yeah.
And so the focus becomes on the material, on the objects, on understanding how they're. So and when people see the title of your book in the shop with this very nice cover, the kind of the immediate reaction is to think that this is very much a book in that kind of tradition, because obviously it makes you think that this is a material city which is resisting kind of meanings and cultural and
yeah.
economic and social structural attempts to change it. So the first question is how does, and this is sort of related to what you said before, how does your account relate to this, to the sort of tension between STS and A&T and to the place of meaning. And also, I mean, with regards to how A&T justifies itself, the justification is that by not paying attention to meaning and to social structures and to political economies, we pay attention to the empirical facts on the ground. And this is what following the actors is for. It's for having a kind of ant-like perspective of the sort of the complexities on the ground.
Yeah.
So this is, and I think this is highly problematic. I think political economies and social structures perhaps sometimes are more important than the actors on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
But this is the A&T kind of fundamentalist empiricist justification of why that kind of approach has developed. So what's your justification for your methodology and for the sort of the processes and the typologies that you developed in your account?
Yeah. Well, that's a really nice question. Yeah, I'm not an A&T scholar, I would say. I mean, you already found it out, I think, on the basis of my presentation. So I think within the field of science, technology, and society studies, you have three major perspectives. That's actor network theory, that is COT, the one that I used, so social construction of technology, and the large technical systems approach developed by Tom Hughes. That's more historical, like historians of technology have developed that one. And I think the main difference between the approach that I took and the actor network theory is that the actor network theory takes a more radical perspective on the kind of symmetry between human and non-human actors in the development of technology. So they really argue that non-humans and humans should be analyzed with the same analytical tools and that they should be given an equal weight in the analysis. And the tradition where I come from, the social construction of technology, that is more has a starting point more in symbolic interactionism. So that means that really the social actors are taking front stage there. So we still start from relevant social groups in the analysis. But at the same time, we should not like confuse it with a kind of social determinism. So that would be like the other way around. So that's, we still try to give weight to material and technological factors, and I think within the notion of technological frames, you can see this, that there is a kind of try to be a balance between like the cognitive factors and the material factors within this within the notion of technological frame. And I think the notion of obduracy, that also has to do with this same debate, that first we had technological determinism, so everything was determined by technological developments and technology developed autonomously. That was the idea of technological determinism. Then we got a counter-reaction to that, and that is then Scott saying, no, relevant social groups shape technology, so we have society shaping these artifacts. And the idea of the obduracy is then to try to find a middle position between that. So taking seriously that material infrastructures resist change, but they resist this because there are humans involved in, and the meanings, they kind of, the meanings become embedded there and the meanings get obdurate. And that is why these artifacts resist change. So that is then, I think, the trick within social constructivism to also take seriously the material agency without resorting to the quite difficult vocabulary of A&T. That is my answer to this.
Okay.
Any other questions? Is that okay? Is it satisfactory? Or
no, I'd like to follow up. I think I should. Absolutely satisfactory.
Okay. Any other questions?
I'm very interested in these two terms as you set them up as sort of two large categories. But I'm wondering to what extent you're playing with ideas of scale within each one, because obviously cities are centers of personal disasters on a daily basis.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
You're looking, it seems like more at a sort of collective disaster, and you know, what in terms of a multi-car accident will be a collective disaster to a certain extent. So how have you sort of teased that out? And also temporal scales, because you talked about disaster initially as something that's very sort of rapid, but then you talked about how local people conceive of the decline of the textile industry as a type of disaster result, which is obviously a much slower process.
Mm-hmm.
So how are you dealing with those temporal and spatial skills?
Yeah, very good question. Yeah, because now I just selected one case. So that's then the case kind of provides the focal point here. But if I would And that's what I want. So this is really a good question. I want to elaborate this research and make like comparisons. Then the car accidents, like the example, or the personal disasters in the city are not the kind of disaster that I think about indeed. So I'm interested in disasters that create material change. So disasters where really some part of the city gets devastated, or where rebuilding in material sense needs to take place. So in that sense, for instance, here in the UK, the IRA attacks in Manchester that also resulted in the redevelopment of the city centre of Manchester could be a case comparable maybe to the Enschede one. So that's the kind of scale that I'm looking at. Then the temporal aspect. Yeah, that's also a very good point to consider whether like slow disasters could also be comparable to this case, for instance. I also thought about, for instance, in Detroit, where you have this like economic decline, where there's also this also results in like parts of that whole neighborhoods being like just empty, no people living there anymore, and then artists try to rebuild, not really rebuild, but make a new use of this economically devastated area. That's very different, but yeah, I think then we see that in a disaster like this, yeah, the actors make connections to other disasters. So by following the actors, as that's my method, you can come across other examples of disasters of different type in the past, and as long as they make this connection, then it becomes relevant for me as a researcher. But I'm still not completely clear if I would also like include a more general or more incremental disaster in my comparative set for this research. I'm not sure yet if I can do that. I think it would be interesting.
And you won't distinguish between disasters which are intentional, such as the bombings, and those which are accidental?
Another good distinction. I mean, the IRA is an intentional disaster. Also, in September 11th, a lot of research has been done on the rebuilding of New York after that, of course. This is unintentional. I think interesting to try and compare and see how that then results in a different way, or maybe in different narratives of resilience afterwards. And maybe also different questions. I mean, the issue of responsibility and accountability come up there as well, and maybe in very different ways. Yeah.
But it's just a very brief follow-up on that, because it's interesting that you sort of the Enschede and the Manchester seem to kind of work intuitively be of a similar scale as in terms of the first one of what you asked. So then you have smaller scale things, and you have slower things, but you also have bigger, you have Beirut, you know, Baghdad, Grozny.
Yeah.
So these scales, are they too large for this kind of analysis, in a sense?
I don't think they are too large.
Large.
No, I think that you, also in the examples that Phil and Campanella described in their editor book, you can see examples like this on different scales, and also narratives of resilience about different types of disaster. So I don't think that is the problem. It's only like how far, I mean, if you compare cases, they should have something in common, and it should be different also enough to make it interesting to compare. So it's really a methodological problem of how to make this selection. But yeah, to me, it's just the material change that has to take place that is at least kind of common, should be a common point for the comparative case.
I have some questions about this. I think Ulrika and that gentleman.
I'm curious to know if you're able to accommodate value judgments in this methodology, because you've told us about these two cases in a very particular sort of way, and made assumptions about what's a disaster and what's not a disaster and so on.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are some people who would look at the rebuilding of the second city, all museums and middle class neighborhoods, and said, that's as big a disaster,
mm-hmm.
as the original destruction of it.
Yeah.
There may be a whole fabric of life.
Yeah.
In these places, and mm-hmm. Certainly there may, we can think of lots of examples.
Mm-hmm.
Where working class neighborhoods have levels of destruction, and middle class move in, and so on. So I mean, there's a value judgment in that.
Mm-hmm.
Some people would agree, some would disagree.
Yeah.
How are you able to deal with it?
Yeah, I think I'm able to deal with that, but I also have to say that I have not, like, so in my methodology, I would just, to deal with it, I would have to interview, like, groups representing very different perspectives about this process. And so far, I mainly interviewed those involved in the, like, from the municipality or town planning perspective. But maybe if you would interview, like, citizens who left this area and didn't want to return to it, maybe they have good reasons for that, then you would maybe just encounter very different stories. And then maybe the kind of value judgments that you hint at, the counter narratives, they might become visible if you interview a bit more and look around the different perspectives.
What is that? You know, if you're accepting that there are these different narratives,
yeah,
what does that do to your notion of what vulnerability is?
Yeah.
Or obduracy, for that matter, as well.
Yeah. No, it just shows that these actors construct vulnerability in a different way. And that they also have different ways of coping or developing, they develop different narratives to cope with the disaster. And it's not necessary. So now I gave examples of people who try to view this in a positive way, but there might be others, I don't know yet, that see, no, this is just an example of, how do you call it, gentrification. It's just now a middle class or upper class neighborhood, whereas we had a nice working class neighborhood. I mean, I've seen these kind of voices as well in some of the accounts about this rebuilding. So I don't think that they would be completely out of view if they are part of the discourse around this rebuilding, as long as they are part of the public participation or the people, citizens that I can interview about this. But I think you're absolutely right that if there are these counter narratives, they should be visible. They should be made visible in research as well. Is that what you mean, or?
I'd like to push you a little further.
Studied so far, that they see this, that the counter narrative is not like taking or having a strong voice at this moment, but in the past it had a strong voice. So in the past 1980s, we just said, well, we demolished these buildings. There was no consideration of reusing these textile factories for other purposes. So then the narrative, well, then the idea was just demolish. But then this change in the 1990s, not only in Enschede, but also in many other Dutch cities, and also in Germany, I know that there is now a kind of reconsideration of industrial heritage, and that it has to be reused, I think maybe here as well.
All over the world.
All over the world, yeah. So I think that trend has then also been picked up in Enschede, and I haven't really heard any criticism of that. Many people just liked it. They thought, okay, these. Also in plans before the disaster, actually, there were already some plans to reuse some of those old factories for other, like, more cultural purposes. And that is not something that was very controversial. Mm-hmm. No.
Agrees. I
potential theory, so...
Like if you have a shopping mall, you wait generally for 40 years because when the concept has changed, you need to reintroduce the concept and it's a good one to do.
Yeah.
And actually it's just 40 years ago, so in 10 minutes, 30 minutes only has to do it.
Yeah, but I think already, so they start this whole process, and then also the owner was involved already from 1988 onwards, so then the mall was only 25 years old at that time. And they did this because they saw the profits decreasing of the shops in this mall. So in that sense you're right that this whole profit idea played a role in the technological frame of the ADP, as I would then rephrase this. So I'm not saying that this whole idea of profit making or what they consider as the right like life cycle of the property of the commercial objects that does not play a role. I mean that is just that's part of their way of thinking, of their consideration, what they find important. So then it's just a way of then what I do is to frame this in terms of this technological frame to try and explain how they look at the world, and then this plays a role. These elements play a role in their thinking. But I don't think that then the moment in which they decide to change or to that, I mean, they were not alone in this process, and they were not the only, like, the, so, and also the city board had an important role in this whole process. So it's not only the property owner that can decide how it goes.
But to me, if you, now it's just your one side and the other side, you place them together,
mm-hmm.
and I think every person does that in the beginning, is, well, what does the owner want, what
mm-hmm.
does the investor want,
yeah.
where are we switching, are we come to an agreement.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But here's a different theory behind it, which is based
mm-hmm.
on Kuhn's heritage.
Yeah.
In what sense does it go beyond the traditional trade-off framework, maybe to say?
Yeah.
Maybe you can all say, because you're all trying to say techniques.
maybe before we expand on this kind of heated intersubjective debate. And if does anybody else have any other questions? There is one in question that makes sure that you can fighting this out.
It's not
a question. No, but any other sort of any other topics that anybody wants to address before we carry on informally discussing? I mean, I have one sort of short. Did you? Well, no, I was just curious about this opposition between obduracy and vulnerability, because they're not really opposites.
No, they're not really opposites.
Obduracy.
I think it's the same,
mm-hmm.
but it's interesting also about vulnerability and resilience.
Yeah.
Because vulnerability is the opposite of obduracy, is the opposite of flexibility, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely.
There is a focus in your account on sort of contingency and on context dependence of obduracy.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
vulnerability, so
yeah.
often of obduracy not being inherent, despite the fact that there is a narrative in Enchilada, for example, of Enchilada having this kind of phoenix history, so in a sense of
yeah.
resilience being inherent in the city. But this doesn't address either obduracy or vulnerability. And you find this in Beirut, you find this in Warsaw, this notion that we are fundamentally a phoenix city.
Yeah. Yeah.
But because you focus on complexity, on contingency,
mm-hmm.
this does suggest that perhaps is a preference in the way you prioritize these categories towards flexibility
mm-hmm.
In your account of where cities tend to lie
mm-hmm.
on this dichotomy, but it doesn't directly address the dichotomy. So
no, it's not. So maybe I pushed it a bit too far. And I don't want to say that obduracy and vulnerability are in opposition to each other. It's just that they are two problems that cities deal with at the moment. And I think I can understand them with a similar like theoretical methodological tools by looking at this context and contingency. In both cases, they are not inherent in the city. So it's interesting if Enschede tries to portray itself as a phoenix, but it might be different like in 10 years or 20 years, or if some other disaster happens, they might come up with a new metaphor or a new symbol. I mean, that's something that can change, and that is something that yeah, at this moment or at a particular moment structures their thinking, and the same applies to Hoogkaterijn. At that time, that point of time in those 10 years, these were the two dominant technological frames, but now they are different. I mean, now there are the other actors involved, they are now really rebuilding the area, so that changes then. So that, and that process I want to study as a researcher, but I think then that the similarity is the way I approach the two problems, the two issues of vulnerability and obduracy. I approach them in a similar methodological, theoretical way, but they are not like opposing terms, not even vulnerability and resilience. Also, I mean, a lot of discussion conceptually about how to define these terms, and are they in opposition or not, how to analyze them. Yeah. Does that clarify a bit?
Well, I suppose, no. I suppose the point is that that's what makes it interesting in a sense, that it's not clarified exactly.
Mm.
But I'm just curious as to whether this needs clarification, or whether perhaps the strength of this account lies in the fact that it isn't, that the opposition isn't clarified, that the terms of the opposition aren't clarified.
I think that would require more like a conceptual analysis of those terms, which I didn't do in this presentation. Yeah.
Did you want to answer that?
Yeah, my question is actually going on a lot more similar lines. I was interested in how you expect how vulnerability to be is defined and understood positively.
Yeah.
And then how narratives of resilience are also about putting a positive spin on the disaster.
Yeah.
In fact, these two things are parallel, whereas the metaphors you use that I use vulnerability and resilience seem to be actually opposed. And so
but then I try to follow the actors in how they do this, how they make these connections, or how they make these oppositions. And then I'm not the one as a researcher doing this, but
sure,
I follow
yeah.
how they do this. And yeah.
So should we go proceed next door?
Yeah.
Or you're doing some
questions
next door,
so.
Thank you very much for your questions.
Quite
and comments.
Provocative, actually, presentation.
Thank you
very much.
Matt, do you have a listen to some of those?
No, actually, the last one was last.
Okay,
so.
The next one, there is Ricky Burdett of the European Heights Theory Group next week. Where is that? It's in the house.
And also, the next term, we continue the city seminar. So far, we have two sort of definitely confirmed people, Asha Amin from sociology here, and Karen Till, who's, where is she based? So these are going to be very exciting, and then there's a couple of exciting surprises, which as of yet have not sort of fully condensed or said those to yourself.
Yeah.
Watch this space, log on to our blog daily, and eventually you will be surprised and pleased and excited. So thank you very much again.
Thank you too.